got a report card. My mom looked at it and said, what does E mean? Does that mean excellent? I don't understand this report card for like colleges, universities. I said, no, Ma, it means I failed. And she says, they're all E's.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Society Animation Podcast. I'm Michael Wakelam. If this is your first time tuning in, this podcast is basically me getting the opportunity to chat with incredible creators from across the industry. Everyone from artists to writers, producers, executives, and more. Now, oftentimes the people I chat to are referred by other guests, or sometimes I'll just happen across some amazing work and reach out for a chat. And sometimes they're much more random. I was in the Canary Islands for an event a few months back and happened to hear Bobby Chu speak. After we got chatting, we went for a drink and I got even more inspired. So obviously I thought, well, if I'm inspired by his story, you probably will be too. So here we are. And I'm glad he agreed to do this and add it to everything else he has going on. Oftentimes when you're planning an episode, there are a few real focus points that you can kind of hone in on to share a story, share the story that you want to share. Other times there's so many potential stories, you have to choose a specific direction and theme. And that was the case here. Bobby, as an artist, has been a part of a bunch of great projects like Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, Ghostbusters Afterlife, the Super Mario Brothers movie. But he also founded Schoolism and the Lightbox Expo. And having heard some of his career story back in Gran Canaria, I felt it probably more impactful to focus on that journey, because I think the encouragement and inspiration that you'll find in it, particularly in this current period of industry turbulence and uncertainty, will have a greater impact than looking at specific projects. But, you know, that'd be great to revisit another angle in the future with Bobby. Also, just because he's a great guy to chat to. The show notes today have links to all of Bobby's work, so take a look. I especially love his endless canvas drawings on his Instagram account, which we chat about briefly late in the episode. Before we get to that, though, if you enjoy the show, please let us know by rating it, sharing it, and commenting about it. We have a variety of episodes over the next few months, including an in-depth chat with Jim Capobianco and his team on his stop-motion feature, The Inventor. That'll be part of a series of a few episodes where we break down specific projects and talk in detail about how they came together, kind of an anatomy of series. Lastly, but not leastly, check out thecreatorsociety.org for details on events and socials. All right, let's jump into today's chat with Bobby Chu.
Welcome, Bobby. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
I'm really excited to talk about your career today. But yeah, as I just said, I'm a little bit worried we'll be speed walking through given the amount of things that we need to cover. There's, of course, the amazing story of Bobby as an artist, but there's, you know, the founder of Schoolism, there's the founder of Lightbox, there's the Nico and the Sword of Light story, which I really want to cover and go over. General Bobby the entrepreneur story. And I'm sure we could have an hour-long discussion about AI, but I think we'll probably have to kick that to another time. And then, you know, you have time to chat with me on a podcast. So yeah, thanks again.
My pleasure. Yeah, whatever you want to talk about.
So whenever I wonder if I'm too busy and I've got my fingers in too many pies, all I need to do is look at your career and just feel really chill. So first of all, like, do you stop? I mean, you just showed me your calendar before that it's, you know, pretty much back to back to back to back.
Yeah, if I have any faults, that's definitely one of them, where if I'm done everything, I don't really rest. You know, I'm kind of restless. I look for the next thing. I actually have had goals of like not doing anything and failed miserably each time.
Yeah, I think we're kind of similar. I was really inspired by your work when I saw it in Gran Canaria, the exhibition in Case 2, and really amazing. And also, let me repeat that invitation to chat on the podcast with Kay. If you're listening to this, come and chat with me. But I was really inspired by your story and, you know, when you spoke in Gran Canaria, and I think a lot of other people would be too. So it's probably best for us to just kind of, you know, hit rewind before we talk about all of your successes, let's chat about how you started and all of your failures to get started. So rewind as far as you want to go back. Tell us how you kind of got started around on this creative path.
Okay. So always loved drawing, always loved art. In fact, when I was in daycare, my mom, she said that she got a report card that said Bobby is really good at blocks. He's always first to line up for juice at break time, and he doesn't talk to anybody. That was really interesting because nowadays I go all around the world and talk,
Talk
right?
to
And
everybody, yeah.
yeah, my parents are always constantly reminding me, shaking their heads, just going, how did this all happen? But anyways, always loved art, right? From when I could pick up a crayon. But I never knew that I wanted to be an artist. I didn't think that that was an option, right? So options can be dangerous when you start taking them away, right? And that's probably the moral of the story because when I was 17, I got a job in the warehouse of a toy company. It's called Thinkway Toys. And they made Star Wars toys, Pixar toys, Disney toys, Marvel toys, all the coolest movies. They made the toys. And so I was working in the warehouse, taking boxes off the trucks, fixing toys that I could fix, things like that, grunt work. But on my off time, on my lunch hours, I wouldn't spend it with the rest of the warehouse people. I found myself wandering into the art department, befriending a person there, Jeff, and Jeff started to teach me this program called Photoshop and this brand new program called Illustrator. And so, as a teenager, when nobody was really messing around with Photoshop, I was. And so I'd spend my lunches just asking him all the questions and everything. How do I do this? How do I do that? And then eventually it got to a point where one day I was bringing in a bunch of broken toys that I fixed, and they're all running around like something was going on. And I was like, this is the other key. I spoke up, Mike. I said something, right? Which normally people that age or people in general might not do. I
Yeah,
said,
definitely
hey,
people that age.
right? I just said, hey, looks like you guys are really busy. Can I help? And so the person, Jeff, that was teaching me looked to his supervisor, his art director, and said, let the kid try. I've been teaching him some stuff. And so they plopped me down in front of a computer and they let me stay after, trying to help them. They let me stay and move me out of the warehouse into the art department. And all of a sudden, I was designing toys.
Wow. And so that kind of took two things. It took your side of speaking up, but it took being in a welcoming environment, willing to try something new as well.
But you wanted like the full kind of thing. So the purpose of me telling you this is because of a bunch of no's, a bunch of difficulties, right? So I was already working as a professional artist as a teenager. What did I think I was going to do when I grew up? Not art, because I didn't think that was an option. So I went to business school because it was like, okay, yeah, if you like art, maybe become an architect, but don't be an artist. Be a lawyer, dentist, doctor, business person. I always liked business, so I went to business school, and it wasn't long before I wasn't thinking about the classes. I wasn't paying attention, and in fact, I started to bring art supplies into my economics class and into my statistics class and things like that, and eventually, I dropped out. I stopped going to class. I went to one exam. I brought a bunch of oil pastels to a multiple choice exam for accounting. I painted a cat. I handed it in and then I left. Got a report card. My mom looked at it and said, what does E mean? Does that mean excellent? I don't understand this report card for like colleges, universities. I said, no, Ma, it means I failed. And she says, they're all E's. Well, I hope you know what you're doing because it looks like you're going to art school. Right? I backed myself into a wall, forced this to happen. I said, heck yeah, I'm going to apply for the hardest art school, you know, within my vicinity, within my means. And that was Sheridan College, the animation program. Did I get in? No. I want to kind of stay on this for just one second there.
Yeah, for sure.
Fighting with my parents, not truly fighting, but, you know, like, I want to be an artist. No, I want to be an artist. No. And then I purposely fail out of school. And then they tell me, I hope you know what you're doing. I'm like, heck yeah. And I don't get in, Mike. That was like one of the most humiliating things that could happen.
Yeah.
And so I, instead, I went to a general arts program where you only needed like a B or something like that, average to get in. So I got in. Good thing about this program was it took the top 5% and it let you bypass the portfolio stage to get into the animation program I wanted to get into. So I did that, got into 5%, got into the program I wanted to get into. Started pretty much second last in my class. I had a teacher that would arrange all the artwork, all the assignments from best to worst. I was second last, but I graduated at the top of my class, right? And when I graduated that year, it was 9/11, you know, it started off with 9/11. And so nobody was hiring. And so now that I graduated, could I get a job? No, right? And so I had a backup plan like many of us do. And my backup plan was to take computer animation because that was a shiny new thing back then. Even though I graduated at the top of my class, did I get into the program? No, I didn't. I don't know why. But it's fine because I went back to the toy company, worked for a year, handed in my portfolio again, got in. Graduated at the top of my class, computer animation. Could I get a job? No, I couldn't get a job. Ended up working at a television studio, animation studio called Nelvana, but it wasn't an art position. It was called a data manager. That's what I was. People refer to me as that computer guy really likes to draw, right? Because I get all these files, see where they go, start copying them over to that part of the server or whatever.
Yeah.
And then as it's copying over, I would draw. And then I'd post it up. Anyways, I would hustle at night doing freelance, whatever I could do, to the point where I was doing about 8 hours of freelance and working 8 hours. And, you know, then there's commute, time to shower, hopefully.
Sleeping about four, yeah.
Yeah. Found myself sneaking into the bathroom, the washrooms in Nelvana, setting my timer for 20 minutes and sleeping, standing up, sitting up, just sitting on the toilet, and woke up to somebody having a violent episode in the next stall. And I was like, this is not for me anymore. I quit my job to start freelance full time. Because at this point, I was doing about 8 hours, right? Making a little bit less than minimum wage. For my freelance. So I was like, okay, if I spend all my time on my freelance, then I should be okay.
Yeah.
So I quit my job, went home, and then turned on my computer to start my freelance career. But would my computer turn on? No, it literally broke while I was at work or something, and the hard drive wouldn't physically spin anymore. You know, so at that point, I just thought, is life trying to tell me something? You know, every time I try to go down this road of being an artist, I get a cow patty in the face. And, you know, no, every time. But then I realized, actually, I remember like one time when I was a little teenager, me and my friends, about eight of us, all applied for McDonald's. And the only person that didn't get hired was me. I don't know why, but I feel like it's life's little gift that you don't see as a gift at first.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
the gift exactly. was creating tenacity for me. Right.
Well, I think I can, you know, just to pause there just for a sec. I mean, I can look at what you do now and you pretty much don't stop. And I imagine that's been, you know, obviously you did different things back then. That's probably been your personality for a lot of your life, though, to not stop, to not give up, because to go from the bottom of the class to the top of the class, and then the bottom of the class to the top of the class, and have no, and then, you know, work for a year until you get a yes. I mean, that requires tenacity the whole way through. And it looked like, what was the practical process for you to go from the bottom of the class to the top of the class? Because I think a lot of people skip over this. Like, you know, that was probably you still doing 6-8 hours work a night for that year to go from the bottom of the class to the top of the class.
I think the thing that really helped me was, in the very beginning of my career, like many others, we have all this energy. We're young and we have all this energy. And so it's okay to spend all of this energy, maybe not in the most efficient way. Yeah. I kind of picture it like a pinball machine just getting banged, you know, back and forth and generally going upwards. I was doing that, but I feel like I was also trying to strategize, right? Like, how do I learn faster? How do I trim down some of that time of development and things like that? So I remember things like, I made a CD, right? An audio CD. There's no music on it. But every 5 minutes, it says 5 minutes have passed and it's my own voice, right? And it's like, come on, Bobby. 5 minutes have passed or whatever. Think about what you're doing. Think about what you want to do in the next 5 minutes. I would try things like this, right? I remember reading that, it might be wrong, I don't know, this is way long ago, but something like Leonardo da Vinci slept for 3 hours at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true. Whatever, I bought into it and I was like, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to sleep for 3 hours at a time. So anytime I felt sleepy, I would set my alarm for 3 hours later. It really messed me up. That doesn't work very well for me. but, you know, always trying things.
You're always trying new things.
That are revolving around, how do I make the learning process more efficient and faster?
Okay, so then you ended up freelancing full time, and I guess that went pretty well. But you had your path from there was fairly quick, wasn't it? As far as your acceleration from there,
it was. But at the same time, a lot of it I didn't know. You know, there was a bit of a overnight success. So how it went from starting my freelance career. So I started my freelance career and then I quickly decided to move home to save money. My brother was also living at home and he hated his job. He was running the family business. And I knew that he hated his job. So I was like, well, I have a bit of talent. You have a bit of money. How about we form a studio together with your money? Right. And he said, pretty much, I believe in you. Let's do it. And I hate my job, so let's do it. So we started a studio and had no jobs. And that's partially why it's called Imaginism Studios, because we actually joked about it and said, it's kind of like an imaginary studio because we have no jobs. Anyways, we did have a plan.
Yeah.
And the plan was to create 3 art books by the time we get to San Diego Comic-Con, because we got a table there. So for 9 months, nothing was kind of moving upwards, right? We're just burning our cash. Nobody's asking us for jobs, really. And so we just start doing our, you know, we had little jobs. They weren't that well paid. But I just started doing books with my now wife, Kay Asadera. And during all that time, it's very, very stagnant. We got to San Diego Comic-Con and we have over 100 new pieces of art in 3 different books. Actually, it's more like 200 pieces, 100 some odd each.
Oh, wow.
Right? So brand new artists, 9 months later, 100 new pieces of art, and we showed our stuff there. And when you kind of like incubate, right? And you put that effort into this incubation, and then you come out later, boom, it's kind of like shock and awe, right? And a lot of times that can be very, very powerful.
Yeah.
And it was for us. So all of a sudden at San Diego Comic-Con, a Disney person comes by, gives us their card. Can we do something? You know, love to work with you. DreamWorks, Universal, everybody. It was like everybody, because they're all like, who are you? What is all this stuff? It looks like you guys have been around for 8-10 years, right? How come I never heard of you?
Yeah.
We don't know that we've only been around for 9 months. It's just we didn't have any jobs, so we're just doing these books full time. That's how we could produce so much.
And so I think you mentioned when we last spoke that your response was not, oh, we're new. It was, we're from Canada.
Right, exactly. The very first person was this person from Universal Studios. And she asked, you know, how come I never heard of you? Oh, it's because we're from Canada. Yeah, I generally, like, one of my principles is that I don't feel like I need to lie. So I don't, you know, at least not on purpose. Maybe I said something that was wrong, like the Leonardo da Vinci thing. But yeah, so instead, we just said, we're from Canada. That's true.
You just choose the truth to tell instead of, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, well, don't we all? Adults to kids when they ask certain questions, things like that.
Exactly. And what was the big thing that came out of Comic-Con?
Right. So we got a few jobs that were really great. And one job in particular was from Tim Burton. Tim Burton's people asked us if we wanted to work on his next movie. We asked, what was that? And they said, Alice in Wonderland. He's making Alice in Wonderland. And I couldn't believe it. Oh my God. Like the story matched up with Tim Burton. It's such a perfect kind of marriage. And yeah, we couldn't believe that we could be a part of it. They said, we just need you for 9 days. It's 9 days of work.
We're
like, that's fine. It turned out to be 9 months.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, incredible work. And I think, you know, for listeners who haven't seen your work, and there probably won't be very many, but, you know, I love your style, but I also love your focus that, you know, your focus is on creatures and fantastical creatures and not even so much characters, you know, but, you know, creatures. And I find it really interesting that you found your niche, you know, that you found this thing that you loved and you focused in on it. And can you talk a little bit about that and, you know, that decision to, or was it not a decision? Was it just instinct to kind of go down this route?
I'm actually building a whole webinar or a whole course about branding.
Yeah.
I had conscious thoughts about my brand. You know, there's certain artists like Charles Schulz, you know, and does Peanuts, and everybody loves Peanuts and super successful. Mike Mignola, Hellboy, and various other things, but generally the same style, right? He just gets better and better at his style kind of thing. But I thought about that and I was like, well, I want to work on movies. No director wants to have the same style as some other director previous to them. They always want something brand new that the world has never seen before, right? So I thought, I don't want to just be known for one style then. Well, then what's my brand if I'm just drawing and painting everything? How are people going to remember me?
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, the subject matter, that will be my brand. Right. And so I thought about what are the things I always draw when I'm not drawing for anybody? Generally animals, generally creatures, generally whimsical, fantastical creatures. So non-violent creatures, you know, because it really became like a thing where it's like, I want to see things that don't exist. And so the only way to do that is to actually draw them out. But overall, I felt like I always identified with creatures, all my life.
Yeah.
Wherever I've been, things like that, I've always been very much the minority, right? And also I have an underbite. So as a kid, kids can be cruel and sometimes they could tease and things like that. I'm very well adjusted, but I think that that's what made me kind of identify with the things that are strange and try to represent things that are strange in an appealing way, which made me perfect for something to do with Tim Burton, right? Because that's his same kind of vibe
I think
too.
that's really interesting because, your creatures are so, different and strange, but, like you say, never violent, never weird in a negative way. And I think that's fascinating. I love, I love whimsy, and so for me, I love that route that you took, but I'm, it's fascinating to me that you were conscious of your brand because, so many artists aren't conscious of their brand. And, just, I think that's a great example or even encouragement to artists to, read up on branding, study branding. And I imagine that I mean, you had this, multi-step process in your education where you went through, design and, you touched a little bit on business and you did all of these little things along the way during your no stages that probably influenced, the makeup of your thinking in lots of ways that you didn't realize until later.
Yeah, the other thing is like I learned a lot from other people's failures. So I saw where there are certain situations where an artist becomes really, really popular. Their style becomes really, really popular. Everybody wants that style. And then everybody starts doing that style, making it kind of a trope, or like it made it kind of cheesy and then
Waters it
made it
down.
not cool. Yeah. And I was like, I can't let that happen to me because, say, I'm not successful like Charles Schulz, but then people all know me for this one style. If Charles Schulz gave us a different style, how would we react to it? We'd be like, no, draw your peanuts. We want that. I didn't want to be caught in that situation. So I wanted people to write off from the beginning. Join me for this artistic journey as I learn all sorts of different things.
Which has positioned you well for, not only the work that you do for films, but also in schoolism, and your seminars and your traveling and your talks and Lightbox, everything kind of, to be able to express in multiple styles, your books, everything, it kind of infuses everything that you do.
Yeah, I brought something for you. So I wrote this down when I was first starting my studio, and then I, tucked it away, moved, and didn't need it anymore. Is that backwards on your side?
Nope, it's forwards. It
Yeah, so you
says,
can see in the very beginning, I didn't know what I wanted to do. Is it in focus?
Do
Okay.
you want me to
So I
read
started
it?
to write on this don't want to side, right? Because I didn't know what I
Yeah.
wanted to do, so I started to write what I didn't want to do. And then
Yeah.
after that, I start to write the opposite on the other side. I start to write some more stuff, and that started to describe my dream job. And I wrote dream job at the top or something like that. Yeah. So for those that are listening, what I didn't want to do was drive far, be away from family, be limited to how far I can climb, and I didn't want to stop learning, right? And so I wrote the opposite. I want to be close to work, be close to family, be in a position of amazing potential, be in a position where I'm constantly learning, travel the world. And this was before I did any of this, right? And the last one was affect as many people as I can in a positive way. And then it has the date, 2005.
That's incredible. And I think, you know, one thing I had in my notes that I wanted to touch on was, you know, that you, first of all, you said you didn't want to drive far. So, well, that rules out LA, you know, and, you, and so you've managed to not be in LA full time. And so, you know, a lot of people do wonder if they want to make it in the industry, do they need to travel? But you've proven that's not the case.
Yeah. You know, it seems a lot more like, makes sense now,
but well, this now, was not in 2005,
2005. I remember having lunch, with somebody before I quit Nelvana, having lunch with a bunch of people. And we're talking about our dreams. I was like, yeah, I want to work on big movies. And they're like, yeah, that'd be cool. I'm like, no, I'm serious. Okay, well, are you going to move to LA? I was like, no, I'm thinking I'd do them from here. And then the guy was like, okay, so you're going to get an agent. And I was like, you know what? I honestly don't feel like I need an agent. I feel like things are different now, you know, with the reach of the internet and all this stuff. Facebook wasn't even in existence at this point. YouTube wasn't even a year old. It was like maybe 2 months old. And then everybody's like, what are you talking about? That's crazy. That's not going to work.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, a great list and just a great example, not only, you know, of the things that are on your list, but to make a list, you know, and whether it's a list that you're doing now for the next 10 years or whether you're going to do it just each year or, you know, month to month, whatever, just and if you don't hit everything, then that's fine. Just put it onto the next, you know, the next year or, you know, move it along. But it's good to have lists and goals.
Yeah, definitely. It's great to be able to keep track.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to kind of come back to that point that you had on there was to influence as many people as possible in a positive way, because most people don't have that on their list. And so we'll circle back to that shortly, but I really wanted to stop on the I'm kind of skipping over some things here for time, but I really want to just stop on the story of Nico and the Sword of Light, because that's a great story. Is it true? Did I catch this right when I was listening to it last time? That it is you basically won an Emmy based on a pilot.
We did. I think we were the first, at least animated TV show to be able to do that. Yeah, we won best in children's programming.
Just tell us that story as briefly as you can, because it started as a comic book, is that right?
A comic book app. Was I had a bunch of friends that moved away after school. They moved to the UK, then they came back after 10 years. We're hanging out at my place. We start talking about the various properties that we've sold to studios, and none of them have come out. Right, in fact, most of them get beaten up so badly by the time it's ready for its final presentation or something, you don't recognize your own baby, right? Because it's like, notes, add a turtle. My daughter loves turtles, you know, things like that. Like, what are you talking about? Anyways, so we started talking and we're like, you know what? We should do something. We should put together a story and put it out there into the world and see if the world likes it, you know, instead of executives. There's this brand new product. It's called the iPad, you know, and we can make. I started to actually tell them about when I was little, and I remember sitting in the backyard looking at some comic books and looking at the comic books and saying to the comic book, if you can come to life. I won't tell anybody. It'll be our little secret. Then I said, now we can do this with the iPad, where every panel in this comic book, you touch it, it comes to life. Sound, everything, animation. And we'll do traditional animation, because that's the groovy animation that we, like, animators, hardcore animators still really love, right? Hand-drawn animation. Yeah. Because also, if it was computer animated, it wouldn't feel like the drawings were coming to life as much.
Yeah.
Anyway, so everybody was like, yes. And we start working on it and we realize how much work it's taking. And it takes 2 years on and off, late nights and weekends. And we put it out there into the App Store. And did it sell well? No, it was crickets. But we were used to it by then. And just like the rest of my stories before, you keep marching forward. Short version of this part of the story is that I think it was like a week or two later, it just explodes. And we get to like number one in our category in over 30 countries and all the biggest countries. And so everybody starts calling us, including Amazon. We went with Amazon Prime to make a show. Amazon Prime is brand new, and we're thinking products, right? Amazon is the king of products. Imagine buying toys right off your TV of that show that you're watching. It never happened, but that's why we went with Amazon. And so we got a budget to make a pilot, did the pilot. A bunch of other properties also got budgets to make a pilot, and then Amazon would choose which show to greenlight. Ours did not get picked. So we only made one episode, but
Man.
it was submitted to the Emmys anyways, against pretty much not telling Amazon and just submitting it anyways. And then we got nominated and then we won.
Oh
And then
man.
they had to greenlight us.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things to talk about or unpack there. I think, the ability to do something independently as a creative has largely vanished unless you can raise those funds independently. But when you do see something that has been, created independently by, renowned artists, people who know what they're doing, it's often really, really good, and does meet with that acclaim. So, I think we could probably agree that, a lot of this system for funding is kind of a little broken in our industry right now. And do you think there's ways of getting back to these creator-led projects?
Totally. We did do a Kickstarter. It did help, but I can tell you, and I think we said it in the Kickstarter as well, we just want to see if people want this thing out there in the world. Because it was funded. We had the money to fund the whole entire thing. But Kickstarter is a really great way to market things. So anyways, the lesson, one of the lessons, if anybody could take any kind of advice, is that stay humble in how you live. When things are going well, stay humble, because then you can create kind of like a rainy day fund, war chest for your next great idea. And that's what we did, right? So we said, okay, well, this is the idea. This is the idea that we've been saving up for, and it paid off.
Yeah, that's great. All right, so back to that item on your list, influence as many people as you can in a positive way. I mean, obviously you've done that through Schoolism and Lightbox Expo and and the travel that you've done around the world. And I know, like me, you're a podcast addict. And actually I've listened to a couple of the recommendations that you gave me in the Canaries. But when it comes to this podcast, I started it with that idea of like giving back to the community, that I'd learned so much from other people's podcasts and, largely podcasts that people did that were not commercial. They were just doing it to give back themselves. And so for me, it was it's a passion project to have these conversations and share them because I think, there's so much power in biography. But, so you, I think from what I understand, you pretty much had that same idea with, schoolism of wanting to give back, but you also then get that byproduct of what you get personally out of it. You get to see, meet, learn from all of these great artists. Can you talk about, schoolism and then Lightbox?
Well, yeah, So I hate to pop your bubble there for just a little bit, but I started schoolism for very selfish reasons. You know, just to be totally, like I said, I don't really lie. So when I graduated college and everything, I'm trying to get my career off the ground, and I'm thinking, where do I go to learn after I graduated, after I'm now a professional? And there was nowhere for me to go learn. And I looked online for any online schools. And at that time, there were no online schools. So then I just decided, well, if I got to make one because I really want to learn. And so I start to ask the people that I want to learn from. And then I'd say, well, and I'll help you with your course. I'll be watching them. I'll do the assignments, give you feedback. And they're like, oh, that's great. You know, and then I got to learn from all these amazing artists. And then because of that very selfish reason, because it's such a genuine reason though, it produced really great quality courses that everybody felt, you know, and that's why I think schoolism has been such a success for well over 10 years, right? Because the goal wasn't to make money. It was a quest for knowledge.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so Lightbox. Tell us about Lightbox because, you know, apparently the only Lightbox I attended when I was in town randomly a few years ago was also the first one, and it's grown massively since then. So tell us, you know, why did you start Lightbox? You know, how did it come about, and how much has it grown in those few years?
I said I was discovered at Comic-Con in San Diego, right? Like that's a giant convention. And back then, it was very much about the artists. You wouldn't even hear about it on TV. Still love Comic-Con, but I do feel like it's evolved, right? It's far more about celebrities now and the movies that are going to come out rather than comic books at Comic-Con, right? So, well, where do we go as artists? I don't feel like we had our own kind of home where we can converge and network and meet each other and learn from each other. And so I have a friend named Jim DeMonacos. He created the Emerald City Comic-Con in Seattle. And at its height, it was over 100,000 people a year, right? It really shut that city down. It was amazing. And then he sold it. The show's still around, very popular still, but he sold it. And I knew he wasn't doing anything. And I was like, called him up. What are you doing now? I'm just hanging out. Well, you know, we got to talk. And then before you know it, we're starting a convention.
Okay, so Lightbox, you know, I loved it when I went. The amount of the complete focus on the art was incredible. Not only, you know, everyone's tables and everyone's sharing their art and selling their art, but the talks were really, really good, although very packed in that first instance. The demos were great. So you talked a little bit before we got on this call about you know, how I guess your ethos and how you kind of put it together, who you give tables to and who you get to talk. But, you know, tell us about, you know, that growth in the last few years and where you're at now.
Oh, it's been incredible. This year is the fifth year. It actually started off quite big, right? That
I
very
thought it
first
was
year.
quite, it wasn't too small when I was there.
That was about 10,000 people that first year.
That's crazy.
Last year, you know, first year is 10,000 people, then pandemic, we did online for 2 years. And then last year, we came back together. That was about 12,000 people. This year, you know, we're on pace to be somewhere around there, hopefully even higher. So what was the question?
I guess,
Like how it came about or
yeah. I
no, I
mean,
answered
obviously, you know,
that.
you partnered there, but so how much of your like day to day? I mean, like you didn't have enough to do. You're probably, I imagine, swamped with Lightbox for a good portion of your year now.
Yeah. I am. It's a big undertaking, a giant undertaking. Our staff balloons to, I think, about 200 or over 200 staff by the time we start the event. We have a zoo license for, like wolves and stuff to
Oh, gosh.
draw. We have, I think we're about to put out a trailer on, but or actually, by the time of this podcast, it's probably out already. You'll see in the trailer it says over 300 guests. There's going to be well over 600 guests. I'm just saying that very, still being modest here. It's
Yeah.
probably going to be much more than that. And it's how many buildings? Four different buildings, all side by side, so you don't have to go across the city and stuff. One is the conference center, which is a two-story building, about 14 different rooms in there, all doing talks at the same time, all different subjects. Then we also, to help with alleviating the lineups, we're also opening up the historical Pasadena Convention Center. That's
Wow.
where the daytime Emmys happen. That's where the moonwalk was done for the very first time in Motown decades ago. And that's where America's Got Talent. That's the same stage, right? It holds over 10 times the amount of people as our biggest room did at the Lightbox that you went to. And that was already a lot.
Yeah.
So I don't think we'll be able to fill that auditorium. So even if you can't get into maybe the panel that you really want to get into, we're putting all the most popular panels into the auditorium so anybody should be able to get in there and watch.
And does this, when you look back at that list of wanting to affect as many people as possible in a positive way, does this pretty much tick that box for you, or you're still hungry for more?
I'm still looking to fill the gaps and things like that, but this does take care of a lot of it. There was another one where it was, well, this is how kind of like my trajectory has gone. If you piece it all together, I created a studio because I couldn't get a job. I can't fire myself from my own studio, so that's good. Tick that one off, right? I want to get better at my job, so I created Schoolism. That's where I'm going to learn. Tick that one off. Well, where are we all going to meet? That became Lightbox Expo, right? And then there's some other questions in my head, and I'm just trying to fill them all until I feel like I'm truly independent of everything that a lot of us feel dependent on.
That's really interesting. Okay, so you have all of these things going on. You have an incredibly large social media following, and you also then have time to do your own personal artwork, which seems to be just because you love it and you have fun doing it. I just want to touch on really quickly those endless canvas drawings that you do. First of all, how long do they take you?
Takes about 2 to 3 weeks generally. And to put that a little context into that for the audience, generally I didn't spend more than 5 days on a painting.
Wow. I mean, I can't imagine the thinking that goes into them, and they're just such a fun medium, isn't it, really, as an artist, to be able to think, oh, what would be in the background there, or what would be through that little hole, or what would, it's such a great medium for a creative, fantastical, whimsical mind to explore.
After you paint for a long enough time and you're doing kind of like the same thing, like I'm painting on my Cintiq pretty much all the time. Sometimes I do a little traditional stuff here and there, but generally on my Cintiq, it's this flat object and I paint on it every day. Mixing it up is really great for the soul. Like maybe paint on your basketball and just like gesso your whole basketball and make something cool on there. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, paint a painting, same kind of thing as your last painting, same kind of dimension, same kind of material, stuff like that. So then I wanted to paint something that, or draw something that was just so big. There's no way to look at this drawing except through a video of me zooming into it, right? And yeah,
just to mix it up. They're pretty incredible, but I guess they also double as great little ads for Schoolism to, you know, stick that logo on the end or that website on the end.
Well, and Mike, for me, I put that in there to justify me spending time doing it.
Yeah.
Right. Because there's all these other things on my plate. So a lot of times I'll look at all the things on my plate and see, can I combine these two things?
Yeah.
So then I just have one thing on my plate.
Yeah. This is important. Look what I did. It's got the website at the end.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so last question, and this might sound familiar to you, but I want you to tell me about a time in your life when it all could have gone in a completely different direction.
Oh, yeah. I have many, honestly. Like, I have many. I think for me, maybe the one I'll share is in the very beginning. I've taken a few big chances, three big chances since we started the studio, right? One was Lightbox, which is a huge undertaking, a huge expense, and not knowing if anybody's going to show up to these four giant buildings. The other was Nico and the Sword of Light, because we funded that ourselves, the app. And that was quite a lot.
Yeah.
But the most risky was starting the studio. Because when you're starting a studio and you're starting it with two or three, you know, one or two other people that are not well established, that are also on shaky ground, it's kind of worse than just having one person on shaky ground trying to start something.
Yeah.
And we had a finite amount of resources that we were just burning through every day because we I said I moved home to start my studio. A month later, my parents are telling me, hey, we're moving to Taiwan. I know you started your studio, but we see how hard you work, you and your brother. So we're not worried about you guys. You'll be fine. All right, take care. And they moved away for 14 years. So when we started the studio, we both had mortgages. We both would have lost our homes if the thing didn't work out in San Diego. It was all riding on San Diego. By the time we got to San Diego with our three different kinds of books, we had to print out at least 1,000 copies of each book. I think about 1,500 copies. All our money's gone.
So you bet it all on the one thing, basically.
Yeah, we bet it all on this one plan, which I don't recommend. But at the same time, I want to be totally transparent here. I definitely worked on another level, knowing that there's no net below me to catch me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting, because I think we always want to share that it's good to have a backup plan. But when you don't have a backup plan, you've got to make it work.
It was truly burning the ships, right? You get to the island, you burn the ships. And then my brother gets to the island, I burn his ship too. I'm like, okay, now this really feels like it's all on my shoulders and I cannot mess this up. I can't fail. Because if I fail just by myself and I start all over, I'm actually okay with that. You know, I feel like I'd be fine. But if I failed and lost everything that my brother has too, I would be gutted.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Bobby, thank you so much for joining me today. It's just been great chatting, and appreciate your time. Look forward to seeing what you come up with next.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. Can't wait to let everybody know. This has been wonderful. And I just want to kind of end this off, if it's all right. I'll just end it off saying, like, and you could end it off however you like, but working on cool stuff like Ghostbusters, that was Afterlife, that was amazing. Super Mario Brothers and various other projects where it really holds a very special place in my heart. It still doesn't hold nearly the importance and the special kind of place in my heart as like knowing the lives that have been changed, you know, just by reaching out, just by teaching somebody something, just by making Schoolism or Lightbox. And that's where the true legacy lies in who you serve rather than the things that you've done, I feel. So there you go.
Excellent. Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks so much for joining me for that inspiring chat. As we all know, this is an interesting time in the industry. So if you know someone who needs some encouragement, please shoot them a link to this one. It'll maybe give them a boost. And be sure to check out Lightbox Expo if you're LA-based or can get there. It's a really great conference for artists. If you'd like to get in touch or to shoot us any feedback, then please email podcast@thecreatorsociety.org. You can find me on the socials. As mentioned at the top, please subscribe, like, or share the podcast if you're enjoying it. This episode was edited by Jonathan Wakelam. Thanks to Rich Dickerson for the music, Mike Rocha for the mix, and our exec producer, Eric Miller. Thanks again. See you next time.